Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And what a journey we're going to take today. We're going to be talking about Chinese cuisine. And you know, historians agree that as far back as 3,000 years, China has had a fully developed cuisine. But they don't really agree or even mention what the cuisine was or what specific foods were used, although techniques are known and techniques are very important. And not only are techniques and ingredients very important, but names of dishes are very important. If you were offered a dragon and phoenix platter with magnolia slices, would you have any idea what you were eating? Oh, it all seems so mystical and so complicated. But here to demystify much of that is my good friend and Chinese cuisine scholar and cook, Ken Lamko. And Ken has just published a new book called Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees, Essential Techniques of Authentic Chinese Cooking. Welcome, Ken. This book, I know, is a long time coming, right?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me here.
My pleasure. This book is just so full of, A, beautiful pictures, but B, wonderful historic information, cultural information, and most of all, ingredients, techniques, and yes, of course, recipes.
Right.
Well, I'm not talking, people can buy the book for the recipes and,
right.
and all that other,
right.
because what I want from you is more information about that wonderful history and culture. In
right.
fact, you said in the beginning of the book that to understand Chinese cooking, you need to understand the history and the diversity of the regions.
Right. I really believe that, you know, to understand the cuisine itself completely, you need to look at the whole context. You need to understand where the food comes from and how it evolved over years and, you know, how it influences the neighboring states and neighboring, or even within China itself, because China is so huge, even though the Chinese civilization really started in the center part of the country, as we know now, which is known as the Central Plain. But, you know, the influence spread out. It went along the Yangtze River to the east coast of China, and then also further down to the southern coastal region of Fujian and Guangdong region. So it is very interesting to see how that evolved, rather than just looking at a recipe. It's wonderful to be able to understand where that recipe comes from and right. how it evolved.
And of course, we know from ancient trade routes and the Silk Roads that foods and ingredients, spices and things were coming into the country and being exported out of the country. So there was this total exchange.
Precisely. In fact, I really personally think of Chinese food as being very cosmopolitan because of that. The Silk Road is a great way of transporting a lot of the different ingredients and also transmitting a lot of the different techniques. For example, cumin and grilling, these are all techniques that was brought in from the Middle East through the Silk Road. And, of course, a lot of the seafood that the Chinese eat, for example, shark's fins or sea cucumbers, they all came from the southern coast, southern waters of Southeast Asia or even from India Ocean, because many of these traders brought those ingredients from the, you know, the seaport, and then that brought into the central part of China.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Listen, I was listening to you were on a show, one of our other hosts, Kathy Irway, a couple of weeks ago. And it made me smile because something that everyone thinks of as just being so Chinese were the hot red peppers.
Exactly. Chili actually is from South America. And it was the...
a new world food there.
Exactly. It was a new world food that the you know, Portuguese trader brought in the, during the 16th centuries. And that was where... when it was first introduced, and it was adopted by the southern part of China, because you know, the cuisine of southern China has always been a lot more spicier. They've been exposed to many of the Southeast Asian spices, so you know, the chili somehow just was readily accepted, and they blended into their regular cuisine.
Right, yeah. Which a lot of people misunderstand. They think the Sichuan peppercorns are the heat in.
Correct. The Sichuan peppercorn actually, you know, provides you with this numbness when you put into your mouth, but the spicy heat still comes from the chili, and so that combination of the Sichuan peppercorn and chili is a really incredible sensation.
Yeah, it really is,
and very addictive too.
That's right. You know, it's interesting because you outlined an ancient banquet and. You know, was older than Roman history, but I could have sworn that I was reading Roman history, because the banquets, the whole format of the banquet, as you said, hasn't really changed, and it's the same as you read in as I said, in you know, more Western civilization in mm-hmm. Roman history about banquets.
Absolutely, banquets. You know, has been around for a long time, and for the very first record of banquets was these. Feast just between the interregnum period of Qing Dynasty and Han Dynasty, and during that feast itself, you know, the whole text described who sits at what location, and also what was served, and you know, so it was an incredible record because now we can actually go back and figure out like 3,000 years ago what it was like being in a banquet.
They had a first course and a
Correct.
Second course and a meat
Correct.
And a fish and Right. finished with fruit. I mean, you know, what has changed? Really, not a lot.
Not much.
another thing that you said in the, you know, to sort of fill people in about thinking their way. I think we have to change the mindset about how people think of Chinese cuisine. And you actually said that people don't think of European cuisine as being one entity. Obviously, we have French cuisine and Italian cuisine and so forth. Well, so it is with China, right?
Correct. China is so huge. You know, and the local ingredients are so diverse that you know, each region developed their own type of cooking. Although many of the techniques were actually very similar, but you know, they adapted to the local ingredients and local taste. As far as spices and herbs are concerned, they're all you know, very often are very local, but. The techniques is basically the same, and it's the same thing as in European cooking, I believe. You know, there are
slice, dice, and right, fry or boil, right?
There's a whole set of standard techniques, but, you know, each region has their own adaptation of that technique. And, you know, I think this is what a lot of people don't understand. China has the same diversity. Unless you understand all those diversity, really, you're not going to be able to understand the full impact of Chinese cooking.
Right. I mean, I think most people know a difference between, let's say, Cantonese cooking and Sichuan cooking. But you do a fabulous job in this new book of really going through each region and describing the region, describing the cuisine. How many regions are we talking about? Where, who, and who's decided on
right.
these regions?
Well, you know, when I was writing the section on regional Chinese cooking, I was struggling with the idea of what I should include, because there is this whole concept of the eight major cuisine of China, and according to eight regions, right? Mm-hmm. But that was basically established like in the late 18th century, early 19th century, when people would just aware of the Han cooking, which is one of the ethnicity in China, and that's the majority ethnicity in China. And so all these eight cuisines are really just the Han cooking, but doesn't include all the minorities around the western part, the southern part, and even the northern part. However, when I started writing this, I decided that, I will use that as the basis because it did make sense during the, early 19th centuries. And then I go from there and talk about some of the other development within those regions. And plus, I added a few other, like, for example, the Hainan cooking and also the Yunnan cooking, simply because they are very popular in Asia and people know about those cuisines. But, we don't know about it here in America or in Western Europe. And I decided that way, I'm showing the diversity a lot more than just including just the eight major cuisines.
All right.
And I decided not to include a lot of the minorities simply because, first of all, I don't even understand it myself.
it's a large region to study. Well, not only that, but you relate so many of the names, the types of dishes, and the styles of cuisines to the many different dynasties, which go back how many years?
4,000
years. Yeah.
Right.
So that, but those have pretty much, that is pretty standard. What is related to which dynasty? Correct.
The truth is, we really don't know what exactly was served during that time. The only thing that we can determine from the records is from tomb records.
Yeah.
And, these are all archaeological sites that people have dug up. And from those sites, people find the cooking utensils, and they also find, records, for example, in the tombs of inventories of ingredients and inventories of cooking utensils and so on. So we're only able to determine that there's a particular type of cooking vessel plus a different type of ingredients, but we don't really know exactly how it was made.
Well, of course, they must have been boiling the meat, right?
But actually, boiling and steaming, we can almost always say that is definitely two of the very basic ingredients, because archaeological finds found cauldrons, and so we know that has, and also there's descriptions of food in some of the old texts that talks about boiling meat and certain root vegetables in liquid. So we know that part probably exists. And in fact, one of the terms that's been used since 4,000 years ago is called geng. And geng actually really means boiling meat into it. But now in the modern interpretation of that, geng actually has become a soup that's been thickened. So if you serve like a corn with chicken soup, and it's like a thickened silky kind of soup, that's usually known as geng, right? Uh-huh. So we do have a few of this term that has been retained over years. And also steaming is very common during that time, because we were able to actually find utensil that looks like layers of steamers with perforation at the bottom. But what they didn't find is the cover. They were not able to find any cover that would cover those.
Uh-huh.
So the speculation was that the covers were actually made from wood or bamboo.
Yeah. And or that's even why, or large rock, who knows?
Well,
I don't know. Yes, no. That's true.
We
don't know.
Yeah.
But the speculation was that it was probably a wood that didn't survive thousands of years. So right. that was one of the speculation.
Interesting. Well, you relate a beautiful story about your travels and your visit to this little village of Cheng Khan, talking about these old techniques. Tell us about that.
Cheng Khan, yes. That is a beautiful little village that I visited near this mountain called Huangshan. And it was a village that's been designated as United Nations Historical Preservation Region. And so everything there is preserved, sort of almost like the time stood still. And, you can go back and see what it was like probably about 200 years ago, because that was when, that village was very actively, quote-unquote, developed.
People are still living
there. People are still living there. People are still living there, right, exactly. And, what struck me when I went into the kitchen in one of these houses was that it is so simple. All there is this little stove. It's a brick stove with two holes, and below the holes are wood-burning, fires. And on those two holes were woks. And above it, you see this little exhaust. Again, it was, just sort of like a brick built a hole with a slight angle, so to bring in to exhaust the smoke out. And that was it. It's as far as the kitchen itself. And then I looked at the utensil. Basically, there was just one. There are two woks on the stove, and one of the wok has steamers in it, and the other one is just open so that you can stir fry. So basically, you're just steaming and stir frying, and the wok can also be used for braising, and actually the smoke above the stove can actually be used for smoking.
Huh.
So it was all in one facility. You can do all those different techniques, and I was amazed.
And you said you walked outside and you saw a big pot.
Yes, I walked outside, and the only thing that was really interesting, I walked out. There was a little garden at the back, and I walked outside and I saw this little stove, wood stove, with a pot of rice cooking. And interestingly enough, the pot itself was the insert of those rice cooker, modern rice cooker that we see. But it's sitting on
the
right multi-purpose.
Oh, that's interesting. That's great. Yeah. Well, we're going to talk more about this with my guest, Ken Lumko, and also about some of those enigmatic names of the dishes and how we got them when we come back after a short break. So stay with us.
You want when you get up in the morning, 'cause it won't be long before you're dead and gone.
Yeah,
no, there ain't no telling.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Okay, and I'm back talking with Ken Lumko, and he has a brand new book, really brand new book, out called Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees, Essential Techniques of Authentic Chinese Cooking. And the title of the book, Ken, is very interesting, mm-hmm. Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees, and so interesting to a lot of people thinking, what is he talking about? But not only that, you wrote a paper and presented it at the Oxford Symposium this past summer, the Oxford Symposium on Food History. And it is exactly that, although you don't call it Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees, that's the book, but Dragon on a Platter.
That's right.
The Art of Naming Chinese Dishes. These names are, I mean, General Tso's chicken or Kung Pao chicken, all these very strange names right. that come up and not real until you really eat them or read a description of them, people have no idea what it is on the menu. Tell me about that.
Right. Well, you know, many of these names really originated from the palaces of the Chinese dynasties. Food and culture and poetry and, you know, scholars, they're all sort of mingled together right. During that period. The general population don't really have this exquisite type of dining and so on. So that's why there's a lot of scholars actually named these dishes for the most part. And so very often they come up with very, very flowery, very poetic names.
Poetic, yeah, definitely.
And so, not only that the dish name itself, but the ingredients. And in fact, you know, because of the fact some of the ingredients were very poetic, and when you put them together into a name, it becomes very poetic. So, we talked about phoenix claws in Chinese cooking. Phoenix claws really represents chicken feet.
And, how much better it sounds.
I know, it makes it a lot more appetizing, isn't it? So, the truth is, for most Chinese growing up, we're familiar with all this term because that's what it's always been called. You know, you go to a restaurant, if someone says, oh, let's have some braised phoenix claws, you know what it is, it's braised chicken feet. Dragon is also very commonly used to represent lobster or shrimp sometimes.
Was the dragon one of the... wasn't that one of the main themes of one of the dynasties, a dragon?
Well, dragon has always been the symbol of the emperor. So,
In the Chinese New Year celebrations.
Correct. All dynasties there, all the emperors, dragon usually represent the emperor, and then phoenix usually represent the empress. So very often, if you go to an official... banquet or something, you know, dragon and phoenix are always there.
And they're always present.
They're always present. So often, you know, what that means is that you'll actually end up with either lobster or shrimp, and then you have a chicken as phoenix. These are representation of ingredients. But at the same time, there are dishes that are poetic simply because they are served for a very specific reason for an auspicious purpose of a birthday party or a wedding or something. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the very interesting items is for a wedding, there's a sweet soup dish called... which really means, wishing for an offspring very quickly, very soon. And that's what the name means. But in order to create the dish, the four characters for Zao Sen Gui Zi was broken apart. And Zao, which actually rhymes with Chinese jujubes, red jujubes. Seng actually is... and it also rhymes with hua seng, which is the peanut, and gui is it rhymes again with the dried longan. And finally, zi, which is lian zi, which also often used to represent fertility, is lotus seeds. So then you take four of these ingredients together and create this dessert, the sweet dessert. And it's become a dish called Zao San Gui Zi to, wish for an early offspring.
And I would assume that most people are aware of the significance of these symbols and dishes over the years.
Correct, because this is such a common item now that, you go to a banquet, a wedding, a party or a wedding, celebration somewhere, almost always there would be one of these dishes comes up and people know about it.
Right, right.
Yeah, so.
Well, you were on the show with me, oh, it was about 3 years ago, I think.
A while ago, yes.
And it was for Chinese New Year. We were talking about, right, the dishes and celebrations of Chinese New Year. And that, too, has a significance.
Absolutely. The so-called New Year cake that usually we served during Chinese New Year is called nian gao. And nian actually means sticky, and gao is cake. So, when you put those two together, because nian also sounds like a year or new year, those sticky rice cake becomes a new year cake.
Huh.
So, we talked about that, and it's this is part of the whole custom of Chinese naming their dishes as an auspicious item. Or
so that is really the homophonic.
That's correct. That's correct.
Name of a dish, and then
correct.
There are the symbolic ones like the long noodle for longevity.
Correct. Correct.
For, and then there's just that metaphysical, beautiful, poetic name that we give them. But you mentioned that often the dishes are named for plant, animal, or a precious jewel.
Correct.
And so emerald, we hear a lot of emerald.
Emerald is very commonly used. Anything that's green, so you can, in fact, you could have possibly like, say, a green celery or something, then, it would call a dish emerald because you have a green item in it. Jade is also commonly used.
The jade trees.
The jade trees being, Chinese broccoli. Pearl is used a lot as well. For example, there's a dish which is beef ball or meatballs with sticky rice covering the whole thing, and we call it the pearl-studded meatballs. So it was like, it's just very poetic. It has such wonderful, implication when you just read the name.
Even the techniques have, a couple of them that I can think of offhand, have very poetic, very beautiful sounding, like velvet, the technique of velveting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you think of velvet, obviously, and it's fuzzy, soft to the touch.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
But that is a specific technique.
That
right?
is a specific technique for stir frying. What we do is we would marinate the meat with a combination of starch and wine, and sometimes with a little bit of egg white. And those combination, when you coat the meat and then you quickly cook it through like either oil or water, it becomes this beautiful silky velvety cover on the meat before you stir fry. And then after you've done that, then you stir fry with the aromatics and the other vegetable ingredients and so on. But that particular technique itself really is a wonderful way of sealing meat, yet also providing this nice, smooth, silky texture on the outside.
To velvet the chicken sounds so much nicer than dredge the chicken. dredge it in a bowl of egg and flour.
Right.
And I'm trying to think of what other techniques might have some poetic names. But that is just, it's such a, as you said, the cooking culture, it was all, they all mingled. They all sat around and mingling together. So these things were all given very poetic
yes.
names. Interesting.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also some of the names of Chinese dishes, you can tell from what is the cut of the ingredients, because I don't know if any of the listeners are aware of mugu kai pan, for example. The pan in the end actually means that the chicken is sliced thinly, so it's a specific type of slices, and chicken on ding. The ding is actually means that you cube it or you dice it into large cubes of about 3/4 inch, and so very often, even with the name itself, you can tell already what the dish is going to look like with all this poetic and flowery description of it as well.
Right. Interesting. So, if you don't necessarily want to learn all the techniques and learn the recipes, just by reading the book, you will be able to read a Chinese recipe or a Chinese menu much more easily.
Right.
Because, as you say, it describes how it's cut. Oh, I see. That's why I've got the little chopped up chicken, right?
That's
Or the mushu,
Right.
Mushu gaipan. Right. All those different techniques. It is. I'm there's so much in this book, and I don't want people to think that it's only just a history book. Of course, it's not. It's just that that's the part that I enjoy, of course. It is so much wonderful technique that really makes Chinese cooking so approachable.
Yes, I think the purpose of this book really is, the book is not for a Chinese cooking every day. It's really for Chinese food enthusiasts who really want to understand the technique, and it gives very detailed step-by-step definition of what each techniques are, and hopefully with understanding the technique, you can then be creative or be innovative with it. After
right.
Once you know the technique, then you can adapt to your own flavor, or you adapt to your own local ingredients. Because I do understand that not everywhere you can find the kind of exotic ingredients that is required for Chinese cooking, but it can be adapted, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
You know.
And in today's markets, there are so many international markets that where these ingredients are available. Mm-hmm. True, years
and
ago
can,
it was not.
Right. And you can also mail order many of these
right.
items.
Right. Right.
Right.
right. Yeah. Well, I just want to congratulate you on a beautiful job.
Thank you.
Book that contains, for my interest, so much history, so much background, and descriptive detail, as well as the actual physical techniques and recipes. Phoenix claws and jade trees. Now you know what you're eating. Phoenix claws and jade trees. Okay. We've demystified that one for you. As always, a pleasure. Kian Lam Ko, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. I've been your host, Linda Palacio, on A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.